out of her throat, Tad screamed again, a shrill, breaking sound. She sat down, almost falling into the driver's seat. She got a glimpse of Cujo coming at her, hindquarters tensing down for the leap that would bring all 200 pounds of him right into her lap. She yanked the Pinto's door shut with both hands, reaching over the steering wheel with her right arm, honking the horn with her shoulder. She was just in time. A split second after the door slammed closed, there was a heavy, solid thud, as if someone had swung a chunk of stovewood against the side of the car. The dog's barking roars of rage were cut off cleanly, and there was silence. "Knocked himself out," she thought hysterically. "Thank God! Thank God for that!" And a moment later, Cujo's foam-covered, twisted face popped up outside her window, only inches away, like a horror movie monster that has decided to give the audience the ultimate thrill by coming right out of the screen. She could see his huge, heavy teeth, and again there was that swooning, terrible feeling that the dog was looking at her. Not at a woman who just happened to be trapped in her car with her little boy, but at Donna Trenton. As if he had just been hanging around, waiting for her to show up. Cujo began to bark again, the sound incredibly loud, even through the safety glass. And suddenly it occurred to her that if she had not automatically rolled her window up as she brought the Pinto to a stop, something her father had insisted on, stop the car, roll up the windows, set the brake, take the keys, lock the car, she would now be minus her throat. Her blood would be on the wheel, the dash, the windshield. That one action, so automatic she could not even really remember performing it. She screamed. The dog's terrible face dropped from view. She remembered Tad and looked around. When she saw him, a new fear invaded her, drilling like a hot needle. He had not fainted, but he was not really conscious either. He had fallen back against the seat, his eyes dazed and blank. His face was white. His lips had gone bluish at the corners. "Tad?" She snapped her fingers under his nose, and he blinked sluggishly at the dry sound. "Tad!"
"Mommy," he said thickly. "How did the monster in my closet get out? Is it a dream? Is it my nap?"
"It's going to be all right," she said, chilled by what he had said about his closet nonetheless. "It's..." She saw the dog's tail and the top of its broad back over the hood of the Pinto. It was going around to Tad's side of the car. And Tad's window wasn't shut. She jackknifed across Tad's lap, moving with such a hard muscular spasm that she cracked her fingers on the window crank. She turned it as fast as she could, panting, feeling Tad squirming beneath her. It was 3/4 of the way up when Cujo leaped at the window. His muzzle shot through the closing gap and was forced upward toward the ceiling by the closing window. The sound of his snarling barks filled the small car. Tad shrieked again and wrapped his arms around his head, his forearms crossed over his eyes. He tried to dig his face into Donna's belly, reducing her leverage on the window crank in his blind efforts to get away.
"Mama! Mama! Mama! Make it stop! Make it go away!"
Something warm was running across the backs of her hands. She saw with mounting horror that it was mixed slime and blood running from the dog's mouth. Using everything that she had, she managed to force the window crank through another 1/4 turn. And then Cujo pulled back. She caught just a glimpse of the St. Bernard's features, twisted and crazy. A mad caricature of a friendly St. Bernard's face. Then it dropped back to all 4s, and she could only see its back. Now the crank turned easily. She shut the window, then wiped the backs of her hands on her jeans, uttering small cries of revulsion.
Oh, Christ! Oh, Mary, Mother of God!
Tad had gone back to that dazed state of semi-consciousness again. This time, when she snapped her fingers in front of his face, there was no reaction.
He's going to have some complexes out of this. Oh, God, yes. Oh, sweet Tad. If only I'd left you with Debbie.
She took him by the shoulders and began to shake him gently back and forth.
Is it my nap?
He asked again. No, she said. He moaned, a low, painful sound that tore at her heart.
No, but it's all right.
Tad?
It's okay. That dog can't get in. The windows are shut now. It can't come in. It can't get us.
That got through, and Tad's eyes cleared a little.
Then let's go home, Mommy. I don't want to be here.
Yes. Yes, we'll... Like a great tawny projectile, Cujo leaped onto the hood of the Pinto and charged at the windshield, barking. Tad uttered another scream, his eyes bulging, his small hands digging at his cheeks, leaving angry red welts there.
"It can't get us!"
Donna shouted at him.
"Do you hear me? It can't get in, Tad!"
Cujo struck the windshield with a muffled thud, bounced back, and scrabbled for purchase on the hood. He left a series of new scratches on the paint. Then he came again.
"I want to go home!"
Tad screamed.
"Hug me tight, Tadder, and don't worry."
How insane that sounded. But what else was there to say? Tad buried his face against her breasts just as Cujo struck the windshield again. Foam smeared against the glass as he tried to bite his way through. Those muddled, bleary eyes stared into Donna's.
"I'm going to pull you to pieces," they said. "You and the boy both. Just as soon as I find a way to get into this tin can, I'll eat you alive. I'll be swallowing pieces of you while you're still screaming."
Rabid, she thought. That dog is rabid.
With steadily mounting fear, she looked past the dog on the hood and at Joe Camber's parked truck. Had the dog bitten him? She found the horn buttons and pressed them. The Pinto's horn blared and the dog skittered back, again almost losing its balance.
"Don't like that much, do you?" she shrieked triumphantly at it. "Hurts your ears, doesn't it?"
She jammed the horn down again. Cujo leaped off the hood.
"Mommy, please, let's go home."
She turned the key in the ignition. The motor cranked and cranked and cranked, but the Pinto did not start. At last she turned the key off again.
"Honey, we can't go just yet. The car..."
"Yes, yes, now! Right now!"
Her head began to thud, big whacking pains that were in perfect sync with her heartbeat.
"Tad, listen to me. The car doesn't want to start. It's that needle valve thing. We've got to wait until the engine cools off. It'll go then, I think. We can leave. All we have to do is get back out of the driveway and get pointed down the hill. Then it won't matter even if it does stall, because we can coast. If I don't chicken out and hit the brake, I should be able to make it most of the way back to the Maple Sugar Road, even with the engine shut down. Or..."
She thought of the house at the bottom of the hill, the one with the honeysuckle running wild all over the east side. There were people there. She had seen cars.
People!
She began to use the horn again. Three short blasts, three long blasts, three shorts, over and over, the only Morse she remembered from her 2 years in the Girl Scouts. They would hear. Even if they didn't understand the message, they would come up to see who was raising hell at Joe Camber's and why. Where was the dog? She couldn't see him anymore, but it didn't matter. The dog couldn't get in, and help would be here shortly. Everything's going to be fine, she told Tad. Wait and see. A dirty brick building in Cambridge housed the offices of Image Eye Studios. The business offices were on the fourth floor, a suite of two studios were on the fifth, and a poorly air-conditioned screening room, only big enough to hold 16 seats in rows of four, was on the sixth and top floor. On that early Monday evening, Vic Trenton and Roger Breakstone sat in the third row of the screening room, jackets off, ties pulled down. They had watched the kinescopes of the Sharp Serial Professor commercials 5 times each. There were exactly 20 of them. Of the 20, 3 were the infamous Red Raspberry Zingers spots. The last reel of 6 spots had finished 30 minutes ago, and the projectionist had called goodnight and gone to his evening job, which was running films at the Orson Welles Cinema. 15 minutes later, Rob Martin, the president of Image Eye, had bade them a glum goodnight, adding that his door would be open to them all day tomorrow and Wednesday if they needed him. He avoided what was in all 3 of their minds. The doors'll be open if you think of something worth talking about. Rob had every right to look glum. He was a Vietnam vet who had lost a leg in the Tet Offensive. He had opened IE Studios in late 1970 with his disability money and a lot of help from his in-laws. The studio had gasped and struggled along since then, mostly catching crumbs from that well-stocked media table at which the larger Boston studios banqueted. Vic and Roger had been taken with him because he reminded them of themselves in a way, struggling to make a go of it, to get up to that fabled corner and turn it. And, of course, Boston was good because it was an easier commute than New York. In the last 16 months, Image Eye had taken off. Rob had been able to use the fact that his studio was doing the sharp spots to land other business, and for the first time, things had looked solid. In May, just before the serial had hit the fan, he sent Vic and Roger a postcard showing a Boston T-bus going away. On the back were 4 lovely ladies, bent over to show their fannies, which were encased in designer jeans. Written on the back of the card, tabloid style, was this message: Image Eye lands contract to do butts for Boston buses. Bills big bucks. Funny, then. Not such a hoot now. Since the Zingers fiasco, 2 clients, including Cannes Look Jeans, had canceled their arrangements with IE. And if AdWorks lost the Sharp account, Rob would lose other accounts in addition to Sharp. It had left him feeling angry and scared. Emotions Vic understood perfectly. They had been sitting and smoking in silence for almost 5 minutes when Roger said in a low voice, "It just makes me want to puke, Vic. I see that guy sitting on his desk and looking out at me like butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, taking a big bite of that cereal with the runny dye in it and saying, 'Nope, nothing wrong here.' And I get sick to my stomach, physically sick to my stomach. I'm glad the projectionist had to go. If I watched them one more time, I'd have to do it with an air sick bag in my lap." He stubbed out his cigarette in the ashtray set into the arm of his chair. He did look ill. His face had a yellowish sheen that Vic didn't like at all. Call it shell shock, combat fatigue, whatever you wanted. But what you meant was scared shitless, backed into a rat hole. It was looking into the dark and seeing something that was going to eat you up. "I kept telling myself," Roger said, reaching for another cigarette, "that I'd see something. You know, something. I couldn't believe it was as bad as it seemed.
But the cumulative effect of those spots, it's like Jimmy Carter saying, I'll never lie to you.
He took a drag from the new cigarette, grimaced, and stuffed it into the ashtray.
No wonder George Carlin and Steve Martin and fucking Saturday Night Live had a field day. That guy just looks so sanctimonious to me now.
His voice had developed a sudden watery tremble. He shut his mouth with a snap.
I've got an idea, Vic said quietly.
Yeah, you said something on the plane.
Roger looked at him, but without much hope.
If you got one, let's hear it.
I think the sharp serial professor has to make one more spot, Vic said. I think we have to convince old man Sharp of that. Not the kid, the old man.
What's the old prof gonna sell this time? Roger asked, twisting open another button on his shirt. Rat poison or Agent Orange?
Come on, Roger, no one got poisoned.
Might as well have, Roger said, and laughed shrilly. Sometimes I wonder if you understand what advertising really is. It's holding a wolf by the tail. Well, we lost our grip on this particular wolf, and he's just about to come back on us and eat us whole.
Roger,
this is the country where it's front page news when some consumer group weighed the McDonald's quarter pounder and found out it weighed a little shy of a quarter pound. Some obscure California magazine publishes a report that a rear-end collision can cause a gas tank explosion in Pintos, and the Ford Motor Company shakes in its shoes.
Don't get on that, Vic said, laughing a little. My wife's got a Pinto. I got problems enough.
All I'm saying is that getting the sharp serial professor to do another spot seems about as shrewd to me as having Richard Nixon do an encore State of the Union address. He's compromised, Vic. He's totally blown.
He paused, looking at Vic. Vic looked back at him gravely.
What do you want him to say?
That he's sorry.
Roger blinked at him glassily for a moment. Then he threw back his head and cackled.
That he's sorry? Sorry? Oh, dear, that's wonderful. Was that your great idea?
Hold on, Rog. You're not even giving me a chance. That's not like you.
No, Roger said. I guess it's not. Tell me what you mean, but I can't believe you're...
Serious? I'm serious, all right. You took the courses. What's the basis of all successful advertising? Why bother to advertise at all?
The basis of all successful advertising is that people want to believe that people sell themselves.
Yeah. When the Maytag repairman says he's the loneliest guy in town, people want to believe that there really is such a guy someplace, not doing anything but listening to the radio and maybe jacking off once in a while. People want to believe that their Maytags will never need repairs. When Joe DiMaggio comes on and says Mr. Coffee, saves money, people want to believe that.
But isn't that why we've got our asses in a crack? They wanted to believe the sharp serial professor, and he let them down. Just like they wanted to believe in Nixon, and he...
Nixon, Vic said, surprised by his own angry vehemence.
You're getting blinded by that particular comparison. I've heard you make it 200 times since this thing blew, and it doesn't fit.
Roger was looking at him, stunned.
Nixon was a crook. He knew he was a crook, and he said he wasn't a crook. The sharp serial professor said there was nothing wrong with red raspberry zingers, and there was something wrong, but he didn't know it.
Vic leaned forward and pushed his finger gently against Roger's arm, emphasizing.
There was no breach of faith. He has to say that, Rog. He has to get up in front of the American people and tell them there was no breach of faith. What there was a mistake made by a company which manufactures food dye. The mistake was not made by the Sharp Company. He has to say that. And most important of all, he has to say that he's sorry that mistake happened, and that although no one was hurt, he's sorry people were frightened.
Roger nodded, then shrugged. Yes, I see the thrust of it. But neither the old man or the kid will go for it, Vic. They want to bury the
Yes,
Vic cried, actually making Roger flinch. He jumped to his feet and began to walk jerkily up and down the screening room's short aisle.
Sure they do, and they're right. He's dead, and he has to be buried. The Sharp Serial Professor has to be buried. Zingers has already been buried. But the thing we've got to make them see is that it can't be a midnight burial. That's the exact point. Their impulse is to go at this thing like a mafia button man or a scared relative burying a cholera victim.
He leaned over Roger so close that their noses were almost touching.
Our job is to make them understand that the serial professor will never rest easy unless he's interred in broad daylight. And I'd like to make the whole country mourners at his burial.
You're crick,
Roger began, then closed his mouth with a snap. At long last, Vic saw that scared, vague impression go out of his partner's eyes. A sudden sharpening happened in Roger's face, and the scared expression was replaced by a slightly mad one. Roger began to grin. Vic was so relieved to see that grin that he forgot about Donna and what had happened with her for the first time since he had gotten Kemp's note. The job took over completely, and it was only later that he would wonder, slightly dumbfounded, how long it had been since he had felt that pure, trippy, wonderful feeling of being fully involved with something he was good at.
On the surface, we just want him to repeat the things Sharp has been saying since it happened, Vic went on. But when the serial professor himself says them,
it comes full circle, Roger murmured. He lit another cigarette.
Sure, right. We can maybe pitch it to the old man as the final scene in the Red Raspberry Zinger's farce. Coming clean, getting it behind us,
taking the bitter medicine.
Sure, that'd appeal to the old goat.
Public penance, scourging himself with whips.
And instead of going out like a dignified guy that took a pratfall in a mud puddle, everyone laughing at him, he goes out like Douglas MacArthur, saying old soldiers never die, they just fade away. That's the surface of the thing. But underneath, we're looking for a tone, a feeling.
He was crossing the border into Roger's country now. If he could only delineate the shape of what he meant, the idea that had come to him over coffee at Bentley's, Roger would take it from there.
MacArthur, Roger said softly.
But that's it, isn't it? The tone is farewell.
The feeling is regret.
Give people the feeling that he's been unjustly treated, but it's too late now.
And he looked at Vic almost startled.
What?
Prime time, Roger said.
Huh?
The spots. We run 'em in prime time.
These ads are for the parents, not the kids, right?
Yeah. if we ever get the damn things made.
Vic grinned.
We'll get them made.
And using one of Roger's terms for good ad copy,
it's a tank, Roger. We'll drive it right the fuck over them if we have to. As long as we can get something concrete down before we go to Cleveland.
They sat and talked it over in the tiny screening room for another hour, and when they left to go back to the hotel, both of them sweaty and exhausted, it was full dark.
Can we go home now, Mommy?
Tad asked apathetically.
Pretty soon, honey.
She looked at the key in the ignition switch, three other keys on the ring, house key, garage key, and the key that opened the Pinto's hatchback. There was a piece of leather attached to the ring with a mushroom branded on it. She had bought the key ring in Swanson's, a Bridgeton department store, back in April. Back in April, when she had been so disillusioned and scared, never knowing what real fear was. Real fear was trying to crank your kid's window shut while a rabid dog drooled on the back of your hands. She reached out. She touched the leather tab. She pulled her hand back again. The truth was this. She was afraid to try. It was 7:15. The day was still bright, although the Pinto shadow trailed out long, almost to the garage door. Although she did not know it, her husband and his partner were still watching kinescopes of the sharp serial professor at Image Eye in Cambridge. She didn't know why no one had answered the SOS she had been beeping out. In a book, someone would have come. It was the heroine's reward for having thought up such a clever idea. But no one had come. Surely the sound had carried down to the ramshackle house at the foot of the hill. Maybe they were drunk down there. Or maybe the owners of the two cars in the driveway. Dooryard, her mind corrected automatically. Up here they call it a dooryard. Had both gone off somewhere in a third car. She wished she could see that house from here, but it was out of sight beyond the descending flank of the hill. Finally, she had given the SOS up. She was afraid that if she kept tooting the horn, it would drain the Pinto's battery, which had been in since they got the car. She still believed the Pinto would start when the engine was cool enough. It always had before. But you're afraid to try. Because if it doesn't start, what then? She was reaching for the ignition again when the dog stumbled back into view. It had been lying out of sight in front of the Pinto. Now it moved slowly toward the barn, its head down and its tail drooping. It was staggering and weaving like a drunk near the bitter end of a long toot. Without looking back, Cujo slipped into the shadows of the building and disappeared. She drew her hand away from the key again.
Mommy, aren't we going?
Let me think, hon, she said. She looked to her left out the driver's side window. 8 running steps would take her to the back door of the Camber house. In high school, she had been the star of her high school girls' track team, and she still jogged regularly. She could beat the dog to the door, and inside she was sure of that. There would be a telephone. One call to Sheriff Bannerman's office and this horror would end. On the other hand, if she tried cranking the engine again, it might not start, but it would bring the dog on the run. She knew hardly anything about rabies, but she seemed to remember reading at some time or other that rabid animals were almost supernaturally sensitive to sounds. Loud noises could drive them into a frenzy.
Mommy?
Shh, Tad. Shh. 8 running steps. Dig it. Even if Cujo was lurking and watching inside the garage just out of sight, she felt sure, she knew she could win a foot race to the back door. The telephone. Yes. And A man like Joe Camber surely kept a gun. Maybe a whole rack of them. What pleasure it would give her to blow that fucking dog's head to so much oatmeal and strawberry jam. 8 running steps. Sure. Dig on it a while. And what if that door giving on the porch was locked? Worth the risk? Her heart thudded heavily in her breast as she weighed the chances. If she had been alone, that would have been one thing. But suppose the door was locked. She could beat the dog to the door, but not to the door and then back to the car. Not if it came running, not if it charged her as it had done before. And what would Tad do? What if Tad saw his mother being ravaged by a 200-pound mad dog, being ripped and bitten, being pulled open? No. They were safe here. Try the engine again. She reached for the ignition, and part of her mind clamored that it would be safer to wait longer until the engine was perfectly cool. Perfectly cool? They had been here 3 hours or more already. She grasped the key and turned it. The engine cranked briefly, once, twice, 3 times, and then caught with a roar. Oh, thank God, she cried. Mommy, Tad asked shrilly, are we going? Are we going? We're going, she said grimly, and threw the transmission into reverse. Cujo lunged out of the barn, and then just stood there, watching. Fuck you, dog, she yelled at it triumphantly. She touched the gas pedal. The Pinto rolled back, perhaps 2 feet, and stalled. No! She screamed as the red idiot lights came on again. Cujo had taken another 2 steps when the engine cut out, but now he only stood there silently, his head down. Watching me, the thought occurred again. His shadow trailed out behind him, as clear as a silhouette cut out of black crepe paper. Donna fumbled for the ignition switch and turned it from on to start. The motor began to turn over again, but this time it didn't catch. She could hear a harsh panting sound in her own ears and didn't realize for several seconds that she was making the sound herself. In some vague way, she had the idea that it might be the dog. She ground the starter, grimacing horribly, swearing at it, oblivious of Tad, using words she had hardly known she knew. And all the time, Cujo stood there, trailing his shadow from his heels like some surreal funeral drape, watching. At last he lay down in the driveway, as if deciding there was no chance for them to escape. She hated it more then than she had when it had tried to force its way in through Tad's window.
Mommy, Mommy, Mommy.
From far away, unimportant. What was important now was this goddamned son-of-a-bitching little car. It was going to start. She was going to make it start by pure force of will. She had no idea how long, in real time, she sat hunched over the wheel with her hair hanging in her eyes, futilely grinding the starter. What at last broke through to her was not Tad's cries, they had trailed off to whimpers, but the sound of the engine. It would crank briskly for 5 seconds, then lag off, then crank briskly for another 5, then lag off again. A longer lag each time, it seemed. She was killing the battery. She stopped. She came out of it a little at a time, like a woman coming out of a faint. She remembered a bout of gastroenteritis she'd had in college. Everything inside her had either come up by the elevator or dropped down the chute. And near the end of it, She had grayed out in one of the dorm toilet stalls. Coming back had been like this, as if you were the same, but some invisible painter was adding color to the world, bringing it first up to full and then to overfull. Colors shrieked at you. Everything looked plastic and phony, like a display in a department store window. Swing into spring, perhaps, or ready for the first kickoff. Tad was cringing away from her, his eyes squeezed shut, the thumb of one hand in his mouth. The other hand was pressed against his hip pocket, where the monster words were. His respiration was shallow and rapid. "Tad," she said. "Honey, don't worry."
"Mommy, are you all right?"
His voice was little more than a husky whisper.
"Yeah, so are you. At least we're safe. This old car will go. Just wait and see." "I thought you were mad at me."
She took him in her arms and hugged him tight. She could smell sweat in his hair and the lingering undertone of Johnson's No More Tears shampoo. She thought of that bottle sitting safely and sanely on the second shelf of the medicine cabinet in the upstairs bathroom. If only she could touch it. But all that was here was that faint, dying perfume.
"No, honey, not at you," she said. "Never at you."
Tad hugged her back.
"He can't get us in here, can he?"
"No."
He can't eat his way in, can he?"
"No."
"I hate him," Tad said reflectively. "I wish he'd die."
"Yes, me too." She looked out the window and saw that the sun was getting ready to go down. A superstitious dread settled into her at the thought. She remembered the childhood games of hide-and-seek that had always ended when the shadows joined each other and grew into purple lagoons, that mystic call drifting through the suburban streets of her childhood, talismanic and distant, the high voice of a child announcing suppers that were ready, doors ready to be shut against the night.
"Ollie, ollie, in free! Ollie, ollie, in free!"
The dog was watching her. It was crazy, but she could no longer doubt it. Its mad, senseless eyes were fixed unhesitatingly on hers. "No, you're imagining it. It's only a dog, and a sick dog at that. Things are bad enough without you seeing something in that dog's eyes that can't be there." She told herself that. A few minutes later, she told herself that Cujo's eyes were like the eyes of some portraits which seem to follow you wherever you move in the room where they are hung. But the dog was looking at her. And there was something familiar about it. "No," she told herself, and tried to dismiss the thought. But it was too late. "You've seen him before, haven't you? The morning after Tad had the first of his bad dreams, the morning that the blankets and sheets were back on his chair, his teddy on top of them. And for a moment when you opened the closet door, you only saw a slumped shape with red eyes, something in Tad's closet ready to spring. It was him. It was Cujo. Tad was right all along. Only the monster wasn't in his closet. It was out here. It was... stop it. Out here, just waiting to... you stop it, Donna!" She stared at the dog and imagined she could hear its thoughts. Simple thoughts.
the same simple pattern repeated over and over in spite of the whirling boil of its sickness and delirium.
Kill the woman. Kill the boy. Kill the woman. Kill the...
Stop it, she commanded herself roughly. It doesn't think, and it's not some goddamned boogeyman out of a child's closet. It's a sick dog, and that's all it is. Next, you'll believe the dog is God's punishment for committing... Cujo suddenly got up, almost as if she had called him, and disappeared into the barn again. Almost as if I called it. She uttered a shaky, semi-hysterical laugh. Tad looked up.
Mommy?
Nothing, hon. She looked at the dark maw of the garage barn, then at the back door of the house. Locked? Unlocked? Locked? Unlocked? She thought of a coin rising in the air, flipping over and over. She thought of whirling the chamber drum of a pistol, five holes empty, one full. Locked? Unlocked? The sun went down, and what was left of the day was a white line painted on the western horizon. It looked no thicker than the white stripe painted down the center of the highway. That would be gone soon enough. Crickets sang in the high grass to the right of the driveway, making a mindlessly cheerful rickety-rickety sound. Cujo was still in the barn. Sleeping, she wondered. Eating? That made her remember that she had packed them some food. She crawled between the two front buckets and got the Snoopy lunchbox and her own brown bag. Her thermos had rolled all the way to the back, probably when the car had started to buck and jerk coming up the road. She had to stretch, her blouse coming untucked, before she could hook it with her fingers. Tad, who had been in a half-doze, stirred awake. His voice was immediately filled with a sharp fright that made her hate the damn dog even more.
Mommy? Mommy? What are you—
Just getting the food, she soothed him. And my thermos. See?
Okay.
He settled back into his seat and put his thumb in his mouth again. She shook the big thermos gently beside her ear, listening for the grating sound of broken glass. She only heard milk swishing around inside. That was something, anyhow. Tad, you want to eat?
I want to take a nap, he said around his thumb, not opening his eyes.
You gotta feed the machine, chum, she said. He didn't even smile.
Not hungry. Sleepy.
She looked at him, troubled, and decided it would be wrong to force the issue any further. Sleep was Tad's natural weapon, maybe his only one, and it was already half an hour past his regular bedtime. Of course, if they had been home, he would have had a glass of milk and a couple of cookies before brushing his teeth, and a story, one of his Mercer Mayer books, maybe, and... She felt the hot sting of tears and tried to push all those thoughts away. She opened her thermos with shaky hands and poured herself half a cup of milk. She set it on the dashboard and took one of the fig bars. After one bite, she realized she was absolutely ravenous. She ate three more fig bars, drank some milk, popped four or five of the green olives, then drained her cup. She burped gently, and then looked more sharply at the barn. There was a darker shadow in front of it now, except it wasn't just a shadow. It was the dog. It was Cujo. He's standing watch over us. No, she didn't believe that. Nor did she believe she had seen a vision of Cujo in a pile of blankets stacked in her son's closet. She didn't, except part of her did. But that part wasn't in her mind. She glanced up into the rearview mirror at where the road was. It was too dark now to see it, but she knew it was there, just as she knew that nobody was going to go by. When they had come out that other time with Vic's Jag, all three of them, the dog was nice then, her brain muttered. The Tatter patted him and laughed, remember? Laughing it up and having a great old time, Vic had told her that until 5 years ago, the Castle Rock dump had been out at the end of Town Road Number 3. Then the new waste treatment plant had gone into operation on the other side of town, and now, a quarter of a mile beyond the Camber place, the road simply ended at a place where a heavy chain was strung across it. The sign which hung from the chain read, "No trespassing, dump closed." Beyond Camber's, there was just no place to go. Donna wondered if maybe some people in search of a really private place to go parking might not ride by. But she couldn't imagine that even the horniest of local kids would want to neck at the old town dump. At any rate, no one had passed yet. The white line on the western horizon had faded to a bare afterglow now, and she was afraid that even that was mostly wishful thinking. There was no moon. Incredibly, she felt drowsy herself. Maybe sleep was her natural weapon, too. And what else was there to do? The dog was still out there. At least, she thought it was. The darkness had gotten just deep enough to make it hard to tell if that was a real shape or just a shadow. The battery had to rest. Then she could try again. So, why not sleep? The package on his mailbox. That package from J.C. Whitney. She sat up a little straighter, a puzzled frown creasing her brow. She turned her head, but from here the front corner of the house blocked her view of the mailbox. But she had seen the package hung from the front of the box. Why had she thought of that? Did it have some significance? She was still holding the Tupperware dish with the olives and slices of cucumbers inside, each wrapped neatly in saran wrap. Instead of eating anything else, she carefully put the white plastic cover on the Tupperware dish and stowed it back in Tad's lunchbox. She did not let herself think much about why she was being so careful of the food. She settled back in the bucket seat and found the lever that tipped it back. She meant to think about the package hooked over the mailbox. There was something there. She was almost sure of it. But soon her mind had slipped away to another idea, one that took on the bright tones of reality as she began to doze off. The Cambers had gone to visit relatives. The relatives were in some town that was 2, maybe 3 hours' drive away, Kennebunk maybe, or Hollis, or Augusta. It was a family reunion. Her beginning-to-dream mind saw a gathering of 50 people or more on a green lawn of TV commercial size and beauty. There was a fieldstone barbecue pit with a shimmer of heat over it. At a long trestle table there were at least 4 dozen people passing platters of corn in the cob and dishes of home-baked beans, pea beans, soldier beans, red kidney beans. There were plates of barbecued franks. Donna's stomach made a low, goinging sound at this vision. On the table was a homely checked tablecloth. All this was being presided over by a lovely woman with pure white hair that had been rolled into a bun at the nape of her neck. Fully inserted into the capsule of her dream now, Donna saw with no surprise at all that this woman was her mother. The Cambers were there, but they weren't really the Cambers at all. Joe Camber looked like Vic in a clean Sears work coverall, and Mrs. Camber was wearing Donna's green watered silk dress. Their boy looked the way Tad was going to look when he was in 5th grade. "Mommy?" The picture wavered, started to break up. She tried to hold on to it because it was peaceful and lovely, the archetype of a family life she had never had. The type she and Vic would never have with their one planned child and their carefully programmed lives. With sudden rising sadness, she wondered why she had never thought of things in that light before.
"Mommy?"
The picture wavered again and began to darken.
That voice from outside, piercing the vision the way a needle may pierce the shell of an egg. Never mind. The Campers were at their family reunion, and they would pull in later, around 10, happy and full of barbecue. Everything would be all right. The Joe Camber with Vic's face would take care of everything. Everything would be all right again. There were some things that God never allowed. It would... Mommy! She came out of the doze, sitting up, surprised to find herself behind the wheel of the Pinto instead of at home in bed. But only for a second. Already the lovely, surreal image of the relatives gathered around the trestle picnic table was beginning to dissolve, and in 15 minutes she would not even remember that she had dreamed. Huh? What? Suddenly, shockingly, the phone inside the Camber's house began to ring. The dog rose to its feet, moving shadows that resolved themselves into its large and ungainly form.
Mommy, I have to go to the bathroom.
Cujo began to roar at the sound of the telephone. He was not barking, he was roaring. Suddenly, he charged at the house. He struck the back door hard enough to shake it in its frame.
No, she thought sickly. Oh, no, stop. Please, stop. Mommy, I have to...
The dog was snarling, biting at the wood of the door. She could hear the sick splintering sounds its teeth made.
Go, wee-wee.
The phone rang 6 times, 8 times, 10. Then it stopped. She realized she had been holding her breath. She let it out through her teeth in a low, hot sigh. Cujo stood at the door, his back paws on the ground, his forepaws on the top step. He continued to growl low in his chest, a hateful, nightmarish sound. At last he turned and looked at the Pinto for a time. Donna could see the dried foam caked on his muzzle and chest. Then he padded back into the shadows and grew indistinct. It was impossible to tell exactly where he went. In the garage, maybe. Or maybe down the side of the barn. Tad was tugging desperately at the sleeve of her shirt.
Mommy, I have to go bad.
She looked at him helplessly. Brett Camber put the phone down slowly. No one answered. He's not home, I guess. Charity nodded, not terribly surprised. She was glad that Jim had suggested they make the call from his office, which was downstairs and off the family room. The family room was soundproofed. There were shelves of board games in there, a Panasonic large-screen TV with a video recorder, and an Atari video game setup attached to it. And standing in one corner was a lovely old Wurlitzer jukebox that really worked.
"Down at Gary's, I guess," Brett added disconsolately.
"Yes, I imagine he's with Gary," she agreed, which wasn't exactly the same as saying they were together at Gary's house. She had seen the faraway look that had come into Joe's eyes when she had finally struck the deal with him, the deal that had gotten her and her son down here. She hoped Brett wouldn't think of calling directory assistance for Gary Pervier's number, because she doubted if there would be any answer there, either. She suspected that there were 2 old dogs out somewhere tonight, howling at the moon.
"Do you think Cooge is okay, Mom?"
"Why, I don't think your father would go off and leave him if he wasn't," she said. And that was true. She didn't believe he would.
"Why don't we leave it for tonight, and you call him in the morning? You ought to be getting to bed anyway. It's past 10. You've had a big day."
"I'm not tired."
"Well, it's not good to go too long on nervous excitement. I put your toothbrush out, and your Aunt Holly put out a washcloth and a towel for you. Do you remember which bedroom?"
"Yeah, sure."
"You going to bed, Mom?"
"Soon. I'm going to sit up with Holly for a while.
We've got a lot of history to catch up on, she and I.
Shyly, Brett said,
She looks like you. You know that?
Charity looked at him, surprised.
Does she?
Yes, I suppose she does. A little.
And that little kid, Jimmy, he's got a real right hook. Pow!
Brett burst out laughing.
Did he hurt your stomach?
Heck no.
Brett was looking around Jim's study carefully, noting the Underwood typewriter on the desk, the Rolodex, the neat open file of folders with the names on the tabs in alphabetical order. There was a careful measuring look in his eyes that she couldn't understand or evaluate. He seemed to come back from far away.
Nah, he didn't hurt me. He's just a little kid.
He cocked his head at her.
My cousin, right?
Right.
Blood relation. He seemed to muse over it. Brett, do you like your Uncle Jim and Aunt Holly?
I like her. I can't tell about him yet. That jukebox, that's really neat. But
he shook his head in a kind of impatience. What about it, Brett?
He takes so much pride in it, Brett said. That was the first thing he showed me, like a kid with a toy. Isn't this neat, you know?
Well, he's only had it for a little while, Charity said.
An unformed dread had begun to swirl around inside of her, connected somehow with Joe. What had he told Brett when he took him out on the sidewalk?
Anyone's partial to something new.
Holly wrote me when they finally got it. Said Jim had wanted one of those things since he was a young man. People...
Honey, different people buy different things to show themselves that they are successful, I suppose. There's no accounting for it, but usually it's something they couldn't have when they were poor.
Was Uncle Jim poor?
I really don't know, she said, but they are not poor now.
All I meant was that he didn't have anything to do with it. You get what I mean?
He looked at her closely.
He bought it with money and hired some people to fix it and hired some more people to bring it here, and he says it's his, but he didn't, you know, he didn't... Oh, I don't know.
He didn't make it with his own hands? Although her fear was greater now, more coalesced, her voice was gentle.
Yeah. That's right. He bought it with money, but he didn't really have nothing to do.
Anything.
Okay, yeah, anything to do with it. But now he's, like, taking credit for it.
He said a jukebox is a delicate, complicated machine.
Dad could have gotten it running, Brett said flatly.
And Charity thought she heard a door bang shut suddenly, closing with a loud, toneless, frightening bang. It wasn't in the house. It was in her heart.
Dad would have tinkered it up, and it would have been his.
Brett, she said, and her voice sounded weak and justifying to her own ears. Not everybody is good at tinkering and fixing like your father is.
I know that, he said, still looking around the office.
Yeah. But Uncle Jim shouldn't take credit for it just because he had the money. See? It's him taking the credit that I don't like. That bothers me.
She was suddenly furious with him. She wanted to take him by the shoulders and shake him back and forth, to raise her voice until it was loud enough to shout the truth into his brain. That money did not come by accident. that it almost always resulted from some sustained act of will. And that will was the core of character. She would tell him that while his father was perfecting his skills as a tinkerer and swilling down Black Label with the rest of the boys in the back of Emerson's Sunoco, sitting in piles of dead